Near the end of the interview, there was a colloquy in which the president reminded the senator of murders in Massachusetts and assaults in Boston as an offset to outrages in the South visited on Negroes and white Union men, under the inspiration of political or race animosity. The two parted that evening not to meet again, the senator leaving with the painful conviction that the president's whole soul was set as a flint against the good cause, and that by assassination of Abraham Lincoln, the rebellion had vaulted into the presidential chair. Meantime, the Massachusetts Republican Convention approved Negro suffrage as a condition of Reconstruction, and they were followed by Vermont, Iowa, and Minnesota. The other Republican conventions were not explicit, but the conviction grew in the North that state governments in the South, which would curb the political power of ex-Confederates and ensure the freedom of Negroes, could not be established without Negro suffrage. Sumner led in spreading this opinion, stressing naturally the rights of Negroes. He wrote to Mr. Bright, November 14th, "The president's experiment appears to be breaking down, but at what fearful cost? The rebels have once more been put on their legs. The freedmen and the unionists are down. This is very sad. I cannot be otherwise than unhappy as I think of it. Our session is uncertain. Nobody can tell certainly what pressure the president will bring to bear on Congress and how Congress can stand it. I think that Congress will insist upon time. This will be our first demand, and then generally upon adequate guarantees. There are unpleasant stories from Washington, but we must persevere to the end." In October, Johnson began openly to argue against Negro suffrage. In an interview with George L. Stearns of Massachusetts, he reminded him that Negro suffrage could not have been argued in the North 7 years before, and that the South must have time to understand its new position. "If I interfered with the vote in the rebel states to dictate that no Negro shall vote, I might do the same for my own purpose in Pennsylvania. Our only safety lies in allowing each state to control the right of voting by its own laws, and we have the power to control the rebel states if they go wrong. My position here is different from what it would be if I were in Tennessee. There I should try to introduce Negro suffrage gradually. First, those who had served in the army, those who could read and write, and perhaps a property qualification for others, say $200 or $250. It would not do it to let the Negro have universal suffrage now. It would breed a war of races." He went on to develop this thesis, which was a favorite one with him, that Negroes and poor whites naturally hated each other, and that the outrages in the South were chiefly of poor whites on Negroes, and Negroes on poor whites, and if suffrage was given the Negro, he would vote with the master, and thus precipitate a race war in the South. That there was truth in this fear, the subsequent history of Reconstruction proved, but it did not turn out as Andrew Johnson anticipated. Johnson had little knowledge of Negroes, although he had owned a few slaves. He accepted most of the current Southern patterns. He believed that the Negro was lazy and could not survive freedom. He was afraid he might be tempted to lawlessness and insurrection. He spoke to certain colored folk May 11, 1865, according to the Philadelphia Press of May 20th, and stated that he had to deplore the existence of an idea among them that they have nothing to do but to fall back upon the government for support in order that they may be taken care of in idleness and debauchery. October 10, 1865, he talked to the 1st Colored Regiment of the District of Columbia troops, who had recently returned from the South. He congratulated them on serving with patience and endurance and exhorted them to be tranquil and peaceful now that the war was ended. "Freedom is not a mere idea. Freedom is not simply the principle to live in idleness. Liberty does not mean merely to resort to the low saloons and other places of disreputable character. Freedom and liberty does not mean that people ought to live in licentiousness. But liberty means simply to be industrious and to be virtuous, to be upright in all our deals and relations with men. You must give evidence that you are competent for the rights that the government has guaranteed you. The institution of slavery is overthrown, but another part remains to be solved, and that is, can 4 millions of people, reared as they have been with all the prejudices of the whites, can they take their places in the community and be made to work harmoniously and congruously in our system? This is a problem to be considered. Are the digestive powers of the American government sufficient to receive this element in a new shape and digest it and make it work healthfully upon the system that has incorporated it? He then hinted at colonization of the Negro population. If it should be so that the two races cannot agree and live in peace and prosperity, and the laws of Providence require that they should be separated, in that event, looking to the far distant future and trusting in God that it may never come, if it should come, Providence that works mysteriously but unerringly and certainly will point out the way and the mode and the manner by which these people are to be separated, and they are to be taken to their land of inheritance and promise, for such a one is before them. Hence we are making the experiment. Congress met in December 1865 with the determination to control the Reconstruction of the Union, and in this there is no question but that Congress was right. If the nation was going backward to the same status in which it was before the war, it was conceivable that this might be done by executive action. But there were two tremendous changes that made this unthinkable. One was the abolition of slavery, and the other was the new political power which the emancipation of these slaves would confer upon the South. Moreover, there appeared from the South, demanding seats at the opening of Congress, the Vice President of the Confederacy, 4 Confederate generals, 5 Confederate colonels, 6 Confederate cabinet officers, and 58 Confederate congressmen, none of whom was able to take the oath of allegiance. The case of Alex H. Stevens, late Vice President of the Confederacy, was especially aggravating. 4 months before, he had been a prisoner at Fort Warren. Pardoned by the President, he waited not a moment to repent and returned to Georgia, was elected to the United States Senate, and was now asking admission, asking to govern the country he had been trying to destroy. Moreover, one of the worst of the new black codes was passed in Mississippi in November. Thaddeus Stevens took immediate lead. He called in caucus 20 or 30 of his followers December 1. On December 2, the Republican caucus met, and Stevens submitted his plan. 1. To claim the whole question of Reconstruction as the exclusive business of Congress. 2. To regard the steps taken by the President as only provisional. 3. Each House to postpone consideration of the admission of members from Southern states. 4. And that a joint committee of 15 be appointed to inquire into the condition of the former Confederate states. Without waiting even for the reception of the President's message, Stevens proposed in the House a resolution for a joint committee of 15 members of the House and Senate to inquire into the condition of the states which formed the so-called Confederate States of America, and report whether they or any of them are entitled to be represented in either House of Congress, with leave to report at any time by bill or otherwise. And until such report shall have been made and finally acted upon by Congress, no member shall be received into either House from any of the said so-called Confederate states, and all papers relating to the representation of the said states shall be referred to the said committee without debate. By a vote of 129-35, with 18 not voting, the rules were suspended, and this resolution passed. This was the first test of political strength in the new Congress. The Senate did not take up the matter until December 12th. The joint resolution was changed to a concurrent resolution in order to make the approval of the President unnecessary. The section of the resolution concerning the reception of members and reference of all papers was objected to, and the resolution was amended so as to direct the committee to inquire into the condition of the states which formed the so-called Confederate States of America, and report whether they, or any of them, are entitled to be represented in either House of Congress, with leave to report at any time, by bill or otherwise. This amended form, the House concurred in, but but passed another House resolution to admit no Southern members and to refer all motions and papers. Eventually, Stevens had his way, and after Johnson's speech of February 22nd, the Senate assented to excluding representatives from the South until both houses agreed. Industry was uneasy at the Stevens plan. The New York Herald claimed it created lack of business confidence, North and South. Such a lack of confidence, of course, would hinder economic development in the South, and to that extent, limit New York's commercial prosperity. Commerce was especially alarmed, lest Thaddeus Stevens should use his machine for carrying out his scheme of confiscation of Southern lands. Such wholesale confiscation, capital could not contemplate. Local harmony, law and order, the development of the vast industrial resources of the South seemed wisest in New York. Johnson, in his message of December 4th, began an extraordinary series of state papers which he could never have written all by himself. Johnson's state papers, including vetoes, were uniformly in good temper, conservative, historical, and well-considered. In the preparation of them, he made use of every person on whom he could lay his hands. Bancroft wrote the first message to Congress. Jerry Black, the hero of Ex Parte Milligan, wrote the Reconstruction veto. Seward, the precise scholar, supervised much that the president wrote. Stanton, the practical lawyer, wrote the bill to admit North Carolina and other states into the Union in 1865. The Attorney General, Wells, Secretary of the Navy, and other members of the cabinet he frequently used. In his first message, he forecast the adoption of the 13th Amendment, which in fact occurred December 18th. He explained that because of this anticipated abolition of slavery, he had proceeded to begin reorganization of the states and admission to their full rights in the Union. He knew that this policy was attended with some risk, but the risk must be taken. The relations of the general government towards the 4 millions of inhabitants whom the war has called into freedom has engaged my most serious consideration. On the propriety of attempting to make the freedmen electors, by the proclamation of the executive, I took for my counsel the Constitution itself. The interpretation of that instrument by its authors and their contemporaries, and recent legislation by Congress. When, at the first movement towards independence, the Congress of the United States instructed the several states to institute governments of their own, they left each state to decide for itself the conditions for the enjoyment of the elective franchise. Moreover, a concession of the elector franchise to the freedmen by act of the President of the United States must have been extended to all colored men wherever found, and so must have established a change of suffrage in the northern, middle, and western states, not less than in the southern and southwestern. Such an act would have created a new class of voters, and would have been an assumption of power by the President which nothing in the Constitution or laws of the United States would have warranted. On the other hand, every danger of conflict is avoided when the settlement of the question is referred to the several states. They can, each for itself, decide on the measure and whether it is to be adopted at once and absolutely or introduced gradually and with conditions. In my judgment, the freedmen, if they show patience and manly virtues, will sooner obtain a participation in the elective franchise through the states than through the general government, even if it had power to intervene. When the tumults of emotions that have been raised by the suddenness of the social change shall have subsided, it may prove that they will receive the kindliest usage from some of those on whom they have heretofore most closely depended. But while I have no doubt that now, after the close of the war, it is not competent for the general government to extend the elective franchise in the several states, it is equally clear that good faith requires the security of the freedmen in their liberty and in their property, their right to labor, and their right to claim the just return of their labor. I cannot too strongly urge a dispassionate treatment of this subject, which should be carefully kept aloof from all party strife. We must equally avoid hasty assumptions of any natural impossibility for the two races to live side by side in a state of mutual benefit and goodwill. The experiment involves us in no inconsistency. Let us, then, Go on and make that experiment in good faith, and not be too easily disheartened. The country is in need of labor, and the freedmen are in need of work, culture, and protection. And then came a characteristic turn of thought. While their right of voluntary migration and expatriation is not to be questioned, I would not advise their forced removal and colonization. Here, President Johnson was clearly envisaging the extinction or voluntary removal of 4 million laborers in the South and the settlement of the problem of their presence in the United States by replacing them with white labor. On the other hand, he seemed anxious to have them protected in their present new status, and it was understood both from the message and from other sources that the president was in favor of continuing the Freedmen's Bureau. The temper of Congress was firm. What should be done in Reconstruction was a matter for deliberation, thought, and care. It should not be settled by the Southern leaders who brought on the crisis, working alone in conjunction with the president and his cabinet. On the other hand, what the nation wanted was by no means clear. There was among its millions no one mind. There was among its various groups no unanimity. The mind of Thaddeus Stevens evolved a course of action. This plan was to set up, at least temporarily, a cabinet form of responsible government in the United States, to put in power a camarilla of representatives of the various sections, groups, and parties, who by deliberation and inquiry would find out what action could command a majority in the House and in the Senate. This in itself was the beginning of a momentous change in our government, a change, unfortunately, never carried completely through. And the failure to carry it through has hampered the United States government ever since. The original idea of the Congress was a small, deliberative assembly in two houses, which should think and argue matters through, and then have their decisions enforced by the executive, and coordinated and clarified by a Supreme Court. But Congress grew to unwieldy size. The executive grew in prestige and power, until during the Civil War he became a dictator, while the Supreme Court was destined to assume powers which would at times threaten to stop the progress of the nation, almost without appeal. Moreover, the contingency of an executive, who, far from being the servant of a congressional majority, was antagonistic and even a contradictory source of authority and action, never occurred to the fathers. They did not intend to have the president a mere mouthpiece of Congress, and for this reason they gave him the message and the veto. But on the other hand, they never conceived that he should be in himself both executive and lawgiver, and yet this he practically was during and after the Civil War. He exemplified, at the time of Andrew Johnson, a new and extraordinary situation in which the President of the United States, in vital particulars, was opposed to the overwhelming majority of the party in Congress which had elected him, and refused, in effect, to do their will. This had to be remedied, and for this, the Committee of 15 on the motion of Thaddeus Stevens came into being in the 39th Congress. It was government on the English parliamentary model, with two modifications. It was responsible to two houses instead of to one, which enormously delayed and complicated its functioning. And it contained representatives of the opposition party, although this representation was often nullified through caucuses and subcommittees. It was the business of the Committee of 15 to see how the government of the United States was to be changed after the war from its form before the war, and this involved first some change in the basis of popular representation, secondly, a clarification of the status of the Negro, and finally, it brought a modification of the relation of the national government to state government, not simply in civil rights, but even more in industry and labor. It was through the first and second that the majority, which eventually dominated the 39th Congress, gained its moral power. It was through the third that the moral power was implemented. Stevens was too astute a politician to stress first the moral foundation of his argument. In his first speech as leader of the 39th Congress, he placed his main argument on representation because he knew that that would appeal to the men sitting in front of him, and representing national wealth and industry. In December 1865, when the 13th Amendment was adopted, a curious result followed. 29 representatives were added to the South. Since the adoption of the Constitution, the basis of congressional representation had been the free population, including free Negroes and three-fifths of the slaves. Stephens said that with this basis of representation unchanged, the 83 Southern members with the Democrats that will in the best times be elected from the North will always give them a majority in Congress and in the Electoral College. They will at the very first election take possession of the White House and the halls of Congress. I need not depict the ruin that would follow. Assumption of the rebel debt or repudiation of the federal debt would be sure to follow. The oppression of the freedmen, the reamendment of their state constitutions, and the reestablishment of slavery would be the inevitable result. That they would scorn and disregard their present constitutions, forced upon them in the midst of martial law, would be both natural and just. No one who has any regard for freedom of elections can look upon those governments forced upon them in duress with any favor. This was the cogent, clear argument of Thaddeus Stevens, the politician. But Thaddeus Stevens was never a mere politician. He cared nothing for constitutional subtleties, nor even for political power. He was a stern believer in democracy, both in politics and in industry, and he made his second argument turn on the economic freedom of the slave. We have turned, or are about to turn, loose 4 million slaves, without a hut to shelter them or a cent in their pockets. The infernal laws of slavery have prevented them from acquiring an education, understanding the commonest laws of contract, or of managing the ordinary business life. This Congress is bound to provide for them until they can take care of themselves. If we do not furnish them with homesteads and hedge them around with protective laws, if we leave them to the legislation of their late masters, we had better have left them in bondage. He then resolutely went further in a defense of pure democracy, although he knew that in this argument he was venturing far beyond the practical beliefs of his auditors. Governor Perry of South Carolina and other provisional governors and orators proclaimed that this is the white man's government. Demagogues of all parties, even some high in authority, gravely shout, "This is the white man's government." What is implied by this? That one race of men are to have the exclusive rights forever to rule this nation and to exercise all acts of sovereignty, while all other races and nations and colors are to be their subjects and have no voice in making the laws and choosing the rulers by whom they are to be governed? Our fathers repudiated the whole doctrine of the legal superiority of families or races and proclaimed the equality of men before the law. Upon that, they created a revolution and built the republic. They were prevented by slavery from perfecting the superstructure whose foundation they had thus broadly laid. For the sake of the Union, they consented to wait, but never relinquished the idea of its final completion. This time to which they looked forward with anxiety has come. It is our duty to complete their work. If this republic is not now made to stand on their great principles, it has no honest foundation, and the father of all men will still shake it to its center. If we have not yet been sufficiently scourged by our national sin to teach us to do justice to all God's creatures without distinction of race or color, we must expect the still more heavy vengeance of an offended father. This is not a white man's government, in the exclusive sense in which it is used. To say so is political blasphemy, for it violates the fundamental principles of our gospel of liberty. This is man's government, the government of all men alike. Not that all men will have equal power and sway within it. Accidental circumstances, natural and acquired endowment and ability will vary their fortunes. But equal rights to all the privileges of the government is innate in every immortal being, no matter what the shape or color of the tabernacle which it inhabits. Sir, this doctrine of a white man's government is as atrocious as the infamous sentiment that damned the late Chief Justice to everlasting fame, and I fear, to everlasting fire. The ensuing debate in the House and Senate flamed over all creation, but it started with a note of moral triumph. The newly elected Speaker declared, "The fires of civil war have broken every fetter in the land," and proved the funeral pyre of slavery. The chaplain of the Senate increased his moral afflatus with religious fervor, thankful that the Statue of Freedom now looks down from our capital upon an entire nation of free men, and that we are permitted, by the dispensation of thy providence and the way being prepared, to give liberty to the captive, the opening of the prison to them that are bound, and to proclaim the acceptable year of our God. The chaplain of the House said, "O God, we stand today on the soil of a nation which is not alone by inference or report, but by the solemn announcement of the constituted authorities, declared free in every part and parcel of its territory. Blessed be thy name, O God, for thy wonderful ending of this terrible conflict." Congressional amendments of every sort poured into Congress concerning the national and Confederate debt, the civil rights of freedmen, the establishment of republican government, the basis of representation, payment for slaves, and the future powers of federal government and the states. Argument swirled in a maelstrom of logic, no matter where it started and how far afield in legal metaphysics it strayed. Always it returned, and had to return, to two focal points. Shall the South be rewarded for unsuccessful secession by increased political power? And can the freed Negro be a part of American democracy? Thither all argument again and again returned, but it tried desperately to crowd out these real points by appealing to higher constitutional metaphysics. This constitutional argument was astonishing. Around and around it went in dizzy, silly dialectics. Here were grown, sensible men arguing about a written form of government adopted 90 years before, when men did not believe that slavery could outlive their generation in this country, or that civil war could possibly be its result, when no man foresaw the Industrial Revolution or the rise of the Cotton Kingdom, and yet now, with incantation and abracadabra, the leaders of a nation tried to peer back into the magic crystal and out of a bit of paper called the Constitution find eternal and immutable law laid down for their guidance forever and ever. Amen. They knew perfectly well that no such omniscient law existed or ever had existed. Yet in order to conceal the fact, they twisted and distorted and argued. These states are dead. But states can never die. These states have gone out of the Union, but states can never go out of the Union, and to prevent this, we fought and won a war. But while we were fighting, these states were certainly not in the Union, else why did we fight? And how now may they come back? They are already back, because they were never really out. Then what were we fighting for? For Union. But we had union, and we have got union. Only these constituent states are dead, and we must bring them to life. But states never die. Then they have forfeited statehood and become territories. But statehood cannot be forfeited. Conspirators within the states interfered, and now the interference has stopped. But as long as the interference lasted, there was surely no union. Oh, yes, only it did not function. We need not now provide for its functioning again, for the Constitution already provides for that. Where was the Constitution during the war? But the war is ended, and now the Constitution prevails. Unless the Constitution prevails, this is no nation. There is no president. We have no real Congress, since it does not represent the nation. But who represented the nation during the war? And by that token, who saved the nation and killed slavery? Shall the nation that saved the nation now surrender its power to rebels who fought to preserve slavery? There are no rebels. The South is loyal, and slavery is dead. How can the loyalty of the South be guaranteed? And has the black slave been made really free? Freedom is a matter of state right. So was secession. Must we fight that battle over again? Yes, if you try to make monkeys equal to men. What caused the war but your own insistence that men were at once monkeys and real estate? Gentlemen, gentlemen, and fellow Americans, let us have peace! But what is peace? Is it slavery of all poor men and increased political power for the slaveholders? Do you want to wreak vengeance on the conquered and the unfortunate? Do you want to reward rebellion by increased power to rebels? And so on, around and around, and up and down, day after day, week after week, with only here and there a keen, straight mind to cut the cobwebs and to say, in effect, with Seward through Johnson, "Damn the nigger! Let us settle down to work and trade." Or to declare with Stevens and Sumner, "Make the slaves free with land, education, and the ballot, and then let the South return to its place." Or to say with Blaine and Conkling and Bingham, not in words but in action, "Guard property and industry. When their position is impregnable, let the South return. We will then hold it with black votes until we capture it with white capital." After all this blather, the nation and its Congress found itself back to the two plain problems: the basis of representation in Congress and the status of the Negro. When it came to the Negro, the old dogmatism leaped to the fore and would not down. Chandler of New York regarded Farnsworth's demand for Negro equality as not only an attack on foreigners, but an insult to white citizens. When the Constitution said "people," it meant white people, and he stood for the purity of the white race. Fink declared that Ohio would never let Negroes vote with his consent. "This is, and of right ought to be, a white man's government," said Boyer of Pennsylvania, and he declared that 18 of the 25 states now represented in Congress would not let the Negro vote. Yet the argument for freedom and democracy loomed high and clear. Slavery, but a short time ago received as a God-given condition of men, has fallen under the banner of a purer morality and come down with the curses of a Christian world. With the fall of slavery must also fall the things pertaining thereto. The master who yesterday had his heel upon the neck of his slave, today meets that slave upon the level of common equality. The Negro should be carefully considered in this question of Reconstruction, for after all, we are our brother's keeper, and we must see that even-handed justice is meted out to the black man, if possible. Woodbridge of Vermont declared, "New social and political relations have been established. 4 million people have been born in a day. The shackles have been stricken from 4 million chattels, and they have become in an hour living, thinking, moving, responsible beings and citizens of these United States. And if Congress does not do something to provide for these people, if they do not prove equal to their duty and come up to their work like men, the condition of the people will be worse than before." The South, represented by the border states, had to confine itself to constitutional metaphysics, or else blurt out, as some of its spokesmen did, a new defense of the old slavery. The West, on the other hand, had a real and disturbing argument, and it was voiced by Voorhees in his dramatic attempt to drive a wedge between Johnson and the Republicans. He said, January 6, 1866, "How long can the inequalities of our present revenue system be borne? How long will the poor and laborious pay tribute to the rich and the idle? We have two great interests in this country, one of which has prostrated the other. The past 4 years of suffering and war has been the opportune harvest of the manufacturer. The looms and machine shops of New England and the iron furnace of Pennsylvania have been more prolific of wealth to their owners than the most dazzling gold mines of the earth. They are the results of class legislation, of a monopoly of trade established by law. It may be said that they indicate prosperity. Most certainly they do. But it is the prosperity of one who obtains the property of his neighbor without any equivalent in return. The present law of tariff is being rapidly understood. It is no longer a deception, but rather a well-defined and clearly recognized outrage. The agricultural labor of the land is driven to the counters of the most gigantic monopoly ever before sanctioned by law. From its exorbitant demands, there is no escape. The European manufacturer is forbidden our ports of trade for fear he might sell his goods at cheaper rates and thus relieve the burden of the consumer. We have declared by law that there is but one market in which our citizens shall go to make their purchases, and we have left it to the owners of the markets to fix their own prices." This was another unanswerable argument. But having made it, what was Voorhees' remedy? His logical remedy would have been to unite the industrial democracy of the West and the abolition democracy of the East in order to fight oligarchy in northern industry and the attempt to reestablish agricultural oligarchy in the South. Yet this was farthest from his intention. His immediate effort was to embarrass and split the Republicans by forcing them to endorse or repudiate their own president and leader. His ultimate program, if he had one, was to seek with Andrew Johnson to restore oligarchy in the South, with a dominant planter class and serfdom for the emancipated Negroes. This was unthinkable, and it deprived the radical West of all moral sympathy and voting power which its economic revolt deserved. What was it the nation wanted? Charles Sumner told the nation what it ought to want, but there was no doubt but that it did not yet want this. Thaddeus Stevens knew what the nation ought to want, but as a practical politician, his business was to see how much of this he could get enacted into actual law. There came before the 39th Congress some 140 different proposals to change the Constitution of the United States, including 45 on apportionment, 31 on civil and political rights, and 13 forbidding payment for slaves. Over half of these affected the status of the freedmen. Before the Committee of 15 could sift these and settle to its larger task of fixing the future basis of representation and the degree of national guardianship which Negro freedmen called for, there seemed to be two measures upon which public opinion in the North was so far crystallized that legislation might safely be attempted. These were a permanent Freedmen's Bureau and a bill to protect the civil rights of Negroes. On the first day of business of the 39th Congress, there were introduced into the Senate two bills on these subjects. The Civil Rights Bill was taken up December 13th, but Sherman of Ohio reminded the Senate that there was scarcely a state in the Union that did not make distinctions on account of color, and wished, therefore, to postpone action until the 13th Amendment had been adopted. Salisbury of Maryland called it an insane effort to elevate the African race to the dignity of the white race, and claimed that the 13th Amendment would carry no such power as Sherman assumed. Trumbull of Illinois, on the contrary, declared that the second section of the 13th Amendment, as reported by his committee, was drawn for the very purpose of conferring upon Congress authority to see that the first section was carried out in good faith, and for none other. And I hold that under that second section, Congress will have the authority, when the constitutional amendment is adopted, not only to pass the bill of the senator from Massachusetts, but a bill that will be much more efficient to protect the freedman and his rights. We may, if deemed advisable, continue the Freedmen's Bureau, clothe it with additional powers, and if necessary, back it up with a military force to see that the rights of the men made free by the first clause of the constitutional amendment are protected. And, sir, when the constitutional amendment shall have been adopted, if the information from the South be that men whose liberties are secured by it are deprived of the privilege to go and come when they please, to buy and sell when they please, to make contracts and enforce contracts, I give notice that, if no one else does, I shall introduce a bill and urge its passage through Congress that will secure to those men every one of these rights. They would not be freemen without them. Congress asked the President for the specific facts concerning the situation in the South. The President replied with the report of General Grant, containing the superficial results of a hasty 5-day trip, and disingenuously tried to suppress the report of Carl Schurz, undoubtedly the most thoroughgoing and careful inquiry into the situation just after the war that had been made. Sumner expressed his indignation and the evident need of a civil rights bill. When I think of what occurred yesterday in this chamber, when I call to mind the attempt to whitewash the unhappy condition of the rebel states, and to throw the mantle of official oblivion over sickening and heart-rending outrages, where human rights are sacrificed and rebel barbarism receives a new letter of license, I feel that I ought to speak of nothing else. I stood here years ago in the days of Kansas when a small community was surrendered to the machinations of slave masters. I now stand here again when, alas, an immense region with millions of people has been surrendered to the machinations of slave masters. Sir, it is the duty of Congress to stress this fatal fury. Congress must dare to be brave. It must dare to be just. He claimed that the Civil Rights Bill, aimed simply to carry out and maintain the Proclamation of Emancipation, by which this republic is solemnly pledged to maintain the emancipated slave in his freedom. Such is our pledge, and the executive government of the United States, including the military and naval authority thereof, will recognize and maintain the freedom of such persons. This pledge is without any limitation in space or time. It is as extended and as immortal as the republic itself. Does anybody call it vain words? I trust not. To that pledge we are solemnly bound. Wherever our flag floats, as long as time endures, we must see that it is sacredly observed. But the performance of that pledge cannot be entrusted to another. Least of all can it be entrusted to the old slave masters, embittered against their slaves. It must be performed by the national government. The power that gave freedom must see that this freedom is maintained. This is according to reason. It is also according to the examples of history. In the British West Indies, we find this teaching. Three of England's greatest orators and statesmen, Burke, Canning, and Brougham, at successful periods, united in declaring, from the experience in the British West Indies, that whatever the slave masters undertook to do for their slaves was always arrant trifling, and that whatever might be its plausible form, it always wanted the executive principle. More recently, the Emperor of Russia, when ordering emancipation, declared that all efforts of his predecessors in this direction had failed because they had been left to the spontaneous initiative of the proprietors. I might say much more on this head, but this is enough. I assume that no such blunder will be made on our part, that we shall not leave to the old proprietors the maintenance of that freedom to which we are pledged, and thus break our own promises and sacrifice a race. But Congress was not yet ready for this high ground, and Sumner's scheme was widely criticized. Whitelaw Reed, in a letter to the Cincinnati Gazette, March 3, 1868, recalled the profound surprise and bitterness of feeling with which Sumner's remarks were received by senators. Republican journals and leaders within the inner circles of the party were hostile. The Republicans were especially afraid of any split with the president, lest this bring the Democrats into power. Fournier of the Philadelphia Press begged Sumner to yield for the sake of harmony within the great political army in which he had been a conscientious and courageous leader. Protests against President Johnson's policy were therefore slow in expression. The nation was weary of war and objected to the military administration in the South. Capitalists wanted pacification of the Southern Territory to open a market closed for 4 years. They wanted any method which would bring the quickest results. Moreover, Republicans held some of the largest states of the North by narrow majorities. Any unpopular step might put the Democrats in power. Office holders did not want to break with Johnson, and candidates for office were timid. Congress made, in effect, the first overture to the South, and instead of forcing civil and possibly political rights, turned to take up the bill which proposed government guardianship and tutelage for the blacks. The Civil Rights Bill was postponed, and the Freedmen's Bureau Bill, which Johnson's message seemed to accept, was substituted. This was introduced as an amendment to the Act of March 3, 1865, and contained the following propositions. 1. That the Bureau should continue in force until abolished by law. 2. That it should embrace the whole country wherever there were freedmen and refugees. 3. That Bureau officials should have annual salaries of $500 to $1,200. 4. That the President should set apart for the use of freedmen and loyal refugees unoccupied lands in the South, to be allotted in parcels not exceeding 40 acres each. 5. That the titles granted in pursuance of General Sherman's orders of January 16, 1865, be made valid. 6. That the commissioner procure land and erect suitable buildings as asylums and schools for dependent freedmen and refugees. 7. That it be the duty of the President to extend military protection and jurisdiction over all cases where any of the civil rights or immunities belonging to white persons, including the rights to make and enforce contracts, to give evidence, to inherit, buy, sell, and hold property, etc., are refused or denied by local law, prejudice on account of race, color, or previous condition of servitude, or where different punishments or penalties are inflicted than are prescribed for white persons committing like offenses. 8. That it be made a misdemeanor, punishable by a fine of $1,000 or imprisonment for 1 year or both, for anyone depriving another of the above rights on account of race, color, or previous condition of servitude. These last sections were to apply to those states or districts where ordinary judicial proceedings have been interfered with by war. The bill was opposed as establishing a permanent bureau instead of a wartime emergency institution. Its great power was criticized, and it was declared that its expense would be enormous. There were special objections to the validation of land titles under Sherman's orders and to the section on civil rights. It was defended as being not necessarily permanent, as in accordance with our Indian policy, and as not being expensive since it was manned by Army officers. It passed the Senate in January 1866 by a vote of 37-10. In the House, Thaddeus Stevens tried to strengthen the bill by the most thoroughgoing provisions for government guardianship yet proposed. These provisions directed that food, clothes, medical attention, and transportation be furnished white refugees and black freedmen and their families, that public land be set aside in Florida, Mississippi, Alabama, Louisiana, and Arkansas, and also from forfeited estates to the extent of 3 million acres of good land, and that this should be parceled out to loyal white refugees and black freedmen at a rental not to exceed 10 cents an acre, and that at the end of a certain period, this land be sold to the applicants at a price not to exceed $2 an acre. The occupants of land under Sherman's order were confirmed in their possession, unless the former owner proved his title, and in that case, other land at the rate of 40 acres a farm should be given to the applicant. The Bureau was to erect buildings for asylums and schools and provide a common school education for all white refugees and freedmen who applied. This thoroughgoing substitute unhappily was lost. The bill, which finally passed the House February 6th, extended the power of the Freedmen's Bureau to freedmen throughout the whole United States and provided for food and clothing for the destitute. A distribution of public lands among freedmen and white refugees in parcels not exceeding 40 acres each at a nominal rent and with an eventual chance of purchasing. The land assigned by Sherman was to be held for 3 years, and then, if restored, other lands secured by rent or purchase. School buildings and asylums were to be erected when Congress appropriated the money. Full civil rights were to be enforced, and punishment was provided for those thwarting the civil rights of Negroes. This bill encountered strong opposition, especially from the border states. Salisbury of Delaware deliberately reiterated his contention that Congress had no right to abolish slavery, even if 3/4 of the states assented. With minor changes, the bill was accepted by the Senate, February 9th. And thus the first great measure of Reconstruction went to the President. Southern slavery had now been definitely abolished by constitutional amendment, and government guardianship of the Negro with land and court protection was assured by a permanent Freedmen's Bureau. What was the answer of the South to this? Where were Southern brains and leadership? Why did so many hide like tombs? Why did the South have to trust its guidance to a half-educated, poor white president and a New York corporation lawyer? Suppose a Southern leader had appeared at that time and had said frankly, "We propose to make the Negro actually free in his right to work, his legal status, and his personal safety. We are going to allow him to get, on easy terms, homesteads, so as gradually to replace the plantation system with peasant proprietors. And we are going to provide him and our poor whites with elementary schools. And when in time he is able to read and write and accumulate a minimum of property, then, and not until then, he can cast a vote and be represented in Congress." What was there so wild and revolutionary, so unthinkable about a manly declaration of this sort? But a native of Alabama knew that this attitude was entirely lacking. I do not think that Congress should wait for the people of the South to make regulations by which, at some future time, the Negroes will be provided with homes, have their rights as freemen acknowledged, be given a participation in civil rights, and be made a part of the framework of the country. They will not do that. You need not wait for it. If Congress can constitutionally commence a system of educating and elevating the Negroes, let them do it, and not wait for the people of the South to do it. It is nonsense to say that the South knew nothing about the capabilities of the Negro race. Southerners knew Negroes far better than Northerners. There was not a single Negro slave owner who did not know dozens of Negroes just as capable of learning and efficiency as the mass of poor white people around and about, and some quite as capable as the average slaveholder. They had continually, in the course of the history of slavery, recognized such men. Here and there, teachers and preachers to white folks as well as colored folks had arisen. Artisans and even artists had been recognized. Some of these colored folks were blood relatives of the white slaveholders, brothers and sisters, sons and daughters. They had sometimes been given land, transported to the North or to Europe, freed and encouraged. Of course, the Southerners believed such persons to be exceptional, but all that was asked of them at this time was to recognize the possibility of exceptions. To such a reasonable offer, the nation could and would have responded. It could have paid for the Negroes' land and education. It could have contributed to relief and restoration of the South. Instead of that, came a determination to reestablish slavery, murder, arson, and flogging, a dogmatic opposition to Negro education and decent legal status, determination to have political power based on voteless Negroes and no vote to any Negro under any circumstances. This showed the utter absence of common sense in the leadership of the South. Their attitude was expressed best, however, not by a Southerner, but by William H. Seward. And it came in the shape of a veto to the Freedoms Bureau bill. If this veto had applied to a civil rights bill or to a bill providing for Negro suffrage, it would have been much more logical. But to veto a bill for the guardianship of Negroes, even though that bill carried and had to carry a defense of civil rights, was reactionary to the last degree. The veto was a shrewd document, as was every argument written by that master of subtle logic. The president was made to say, "I share with Congress the strongest desire to secure to the freedmen the full enjoyment of their freedom and property and their entire independence and equality in making contracts for their labor." But he objected to the bill because it was unconstitutional, because the Bureau was permanent, because it did for the colored people what had never been done for white people, because it confiscated land, and because its cost would be prodigious. It was unconstitutional because it extended jurisdiction all over the United States and gave the Bureau judicial power in that jurisdiction. It was made permanent in spite of the fact that slavery had been abolished. Conceive a president, born a poor white laborer, saying, "Congress has never felt itself authorized to spend public money for renting homes for white people honestly toiling day and night, and it was never intended that freedmen should be fed, clothed, educated, and sheltered by the United States. The idea upon which slaves were assisted to freedom was that they become a self-sustaining population." The Bureau, he said, would be costly. During war times, we had already spent $5,876,272 for the relief of Negroes, and $2,047,297 for the relief of whites. For 1866, the present Bureau needed $11,745,000. Now we are planning to spend money for land and education, which will double this sum. The bill proposes to take away land from former owners without due process of law. Finally comes this extraordinary economic philosophy for serfs. Undoubtedly, the freedman should be protected, but he should be protected by the civil authorities, especially by the exercise of all constitutional powers of the courts of the United States and of the states. His condition is not so bad. His labor is in demand, and he can change his dwelling place if one community or state does not please him. The laws that regulate supply and demand will regulate his wages. The freedmen can protect themselves, and being free, they could be self-sustaining, capable of selecting their own employment, insisting on proper wages, and establishing and maintaining their own asylums and schools. It is earnestly hoped that instead of wasting away, they will, by their own efforts, establish for themselves a condition of responsibility and prosperity. It is certain that they can attain that condition only through their own merits and exertions. This was the answer of Andrew Johnson and William H. Seward to the Freedmen's Bureau bill. Practically, it said that the Negroes do not need protection. They are free. Let them go to work, earn wages, and support their own schools. Their civil rights and political rights must depend entirely upon their former masters, and the United States has no constitutional authority to interfere to help them. As Stevens said later, the president himself favored confiscation of Southern land for the poor when he was clothed and in his right mind.